Because the answer is franchising. In honor of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, what's a book series from your youth that deserved a multi-film series?
I'm Katie Rich, and there was a point where Diablo Cody was going to make a Sweet Valley High series, and I still think that's such a good idea for like a Mean Girls, maybe some 21 Jump Street style kind of comedy about smart and mean girls.
Hey, it's me, Dave with the Seven. Sideways stories from Wayside School. There's not really a plot, but there are characters in one hell of a location. This is, means you have to Google the book now.
I'm Matt Patches, and for some fucking reason, we've gotten The Tale of Despero as a movie, but no Redwall movies. I don't know what's wrong with people. Don't we want to see mice fighting mice with swords? Come on.
I'm David Ehrlich. I knew Patches was going to say the Redwall series.
I feel like we may have done this question before, because
I have talked about Brian Jacques on this podcast before and the tragedy that occurred when I was on a family vacation when he came to read at my school in like fourth grade.
Why? Was he a horrible man?
What do you mean? No, the tragedy was that I wasn't there.
Oh, the tragedy. I'm sorry. I missed the part where you weren't there. I thought he was like spouting racist rhetoric or something.
I'm sure he was. But
that sounds like something that would happen in Wayside School.
Anyway, those Ralph Bakshi books type. I read, so I'm gonna go with them.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 166. It's Tuesday, May 16th, and on this day in 1986, 31 years ago, Top Gun was released. And someday in the future, Top Gun 2 will be made. And Matt Patches will eat a shoe. You remember making that bet.
I thought David was singing the Twin Peaks theme song.
He is. He's singing the Twin Peaks
Top Gun. I was really confused.
The Twin Peaks theme song is very similar to the song from Top Gun. It's like, touch me every night. They have the same
isn't it Take My Breath Away? Isn't that the song?
Yeah, but that's how it gets there. You know,
touch me every night.
There are verses before. You don't just start with, take my breath away. You gotta build,
I request shots of Top Gun cut to Angelo Badalamenti's Twin Peaks theme, please.
All right, we're spoiling our own podcast. We'll get to Twin Peaks. But we have reviews first.
Review first. one is better than none, but worse than more. Maybe, question mark, says, it's a podcast, and a good one at that. I don't necessarily have anything interesting to say. I love this podcast and all the hosts. I delight in these guys' opinions and coverage of pop culture, and I welcome the varying perspectives offered by them and their guests. If you like interesting discussion that can offer you a different point of view on a variety of topics, enjoy humor and awesome music transitions, this is a podcast for you. P.S. Best intro for anything ever. I mouth it every song episode.
Congratulations, Dave.
Wow.
Yeah. You know what we need to do to get more reviews, though, is have a review that talks about how horrible Joanna Robinson is, and then she could tweet it, and then we just get like a wave of people responding.
So we're trolling. We're having people troll Joanna just so we can get more reviews. That seems like not a very nice thing to do.
I feel like we should at least save that for the next Blu-ray giveaway.
I decided to write a negative review about Joanna Robinson before Dave said anything. I was going to do it anyway.
Is that Trump reviewing our podcast? If Trump reviewed our podcast, that would also be... If he says something mean about it, then we're really in good shape.
Actually, I think that should be some... That sounds like a challenge to me.
Get Trump to tweet about Fighting in the War Room. Seems worth it.
But also give us 5 stars, because that could quickly blow up in our faces with everyone just embracing the spirit of Trump. And
maybe he'll really like us. Maybe we'll be his Fox and friends.
Unlikely.
Well, he's only screamed Finding Dory in the White House so far. He hasn't had time to see other movies, apparently. So.
But the White House movie theater is open for tours now. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So he spends all his time in the White House watching television, and now you can too.
TiVo, the greatest invention of all time. Yeah. That's what his Twitter bio reads.
review our podcast as Trump or not, just leave us 5 stars no matter what. You can write like a mean Trump style review, just leave 5 stars. Like that's there's a method here. And David's about to leave for Cannes, so what better gift could you give to him before he departs the country? You want him to come back, don't you?
Au revoir.
Dave,
yeah.
So I actually would have pegged you for someone who would have watched Twin Peaks, like, because when I saw it, it was like something I saw in college. It was like the underground thing that like cool kids knew about to watch. I like watched dubbed Danish downloaded illegally versions, and that just seems like something that you would have done in college. So I was very surprised to see that you hadn't gotten to Twin Peaks yet.
Yeah, I went. I guess X-Files was my trading VHS tapes, and if you missed it, you missed it sort of thing. And that was, you know, obviously inspired by Twin Peaks. And so I feel like I absorbed parts of it, but because it was, you know, such like a cult thing, it actually was pretty easy until I knew that I had to avoid it because I wanted to experience it clean the first time through, to just like not know by proxy that people were not talking about how good their coffee was just off the cuff, you know? So it's like, I'm pretty sure I've been in discussions that have been about Twin Peaks and maybe like not known it, because who the fuck is going to know like cream corn is pain and sorrow unless you've experienced the whole thing. The good thing is that nobody was, you know, brash enough to just come out after I had admitted to not watching Twin Peaks and actually spoiled the murder for me. Even though I think that even if they had tried to explain all of Twin Peaks, at some point I would have just had to see it to see how all that was pulled off.
Well, but because who killed Laura Palmer is like the animating mystery of the beginning of the series, but what makes Twin Peaks good and interesting has nothing to do with like identifying the murderer.
Right.
Correct. But that being said, it does help when I was watching it completely clean to have something to sort of pull you through the more experimental or more boring side plots that happen. So
I like experimental slash boring.
Here, did you get bored before the identity of the killer was revealed? Because that's typically the cutoff point where the show kind of goes off the rails.
No, I was with it all the way through the killer. I thought the second season premiere was, you know, Lynchian slow because he kind of hated something about the series.
But it's also one of the few episodes he directed. Like, all of the episodes he directed, I think there are only three of them, are excellent. Special shout out, sorry, before you continue, to Diane Keaton, who directs the shit out of one of the most boringly written episodes in the series in the second season, where like nothing of value happens, but she brings a visual style to the show that is completely absent in every other episode. It's a lot.
Did she
more,
ever make a movie? Did she ever do a movie?
She directed like Because I Said So, I want to say. No, is that true?
She was in that.
She was definitely
directed. She directed a film, I think. But she, I mean, like, she really composes every frame in this episode. It's a lot less slapdash than really any network TV that you would see back then, or even now, of course.
Diane Keaton directed Hanging Up, which
Hanging Up. That's
to be fair, Because I Said So is not dissimilar.
She really, I mean, I don't know if this style would have fit the whole series, but like, it's so interesting how she did it, and it's so well considered, and it's worth checking out even if you're not really all that interested in what's happening, because I don't think she was either.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the interesting thing about watching all of Twin Peaks and watching it compressed is that the speed at which the series unfolds is so much is at a 1990s pace was even slow. at certain times, so it encourages, if you're really into television and you know you're watching something groundbreaking, like real-time analysis, that for things like, you know, Game of Thrones or Lost or whatever, it's actually kind of better to stew in between those episodes. But it's like, you know, I could be watching Should We or Should We Not, you know, be Miss Twin Peaks in this pageant, and also be trying to figure out, like, how involved Frost and Lynch are at the edges of these episodes the other people, like, wrote and directed. So it was fun to watch in, like, a critical standpoint. And after watching the series and then watching Fire Walk With Me and then watching The Missing Pieces, I feel like it as an entire work is worth the boredom of those episodes, just the way it sort of rounds out the character of the entire town. So, I mean, it's weird that it's ended up being as bingeable as it was, considering their new season 3 episodes, like, more than 25 years later, start next Sunday.
But here is the $64,000 question. The entertainment culture, at least, that Twin Peaks is re-entering now is vastly different than the one that it existed and frustrated in the early 1990s. I anticipate that Twin Peaks will frustrate modern audiences, the new version, the new series, rather, in a new way, in that, you know, so much, as Katie said, so little Twin Peaks is about the actual mystery, and so much of it is about pretty much everything else. And as David Lynch's career went on from there, he began actively trolling viewers. I will never forget buying the Mulholland Drive DVD and looking at the liner notes that have David Lynch.
Here are the clues.
10 clues. Yeah, 10 clues to figure out the movie. And you're like, fuck you. Like, this is, like, this show, I wonder, for the sleuth-like viewers, the people who like to go on Reddit and unpack fan theories and so on, I not only anticipate, but deeply hope that the new season makes no sense whatsoever.
Yes, yes. I'm with you. I want it to be impenetrable, and I want it to, like, add but subtract nothing.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, Dave.
I wonder if it's going
to
anger people again.
Dave, you just watched the whole series again, and when I remember when they announced the Twin Peaks revival in the first place, I was kind of left thinking, like, what would they do? Like, why would it need to come back? Do you feel like there are questions, and I'm making quote figures here, to answer, or there's a reason to continue Twin Peaks, or is it just to luxuriate in the Lynchian confusion, in the miasma of weird images and ideas and dialogue that he's able to kind of put together? Like, why does it need to come back?
I think you have Mark Frost, who, when he does, like, Twin Peaks books and stuff, is about, like, the minutiae of the town and, like, a serious plot thread that, like, winds through different people's lives. And David Lynch is, like, the one who's coming in and changing scripts on the fly and directing Red Room scenes based on, like, how he feels at the moment and, like, sort of tying this all together. The interesting thing is, since the series aired, where they were, I'm sure, in an active fight with the network and it was super popular and all eyes were on them, they both sort of come back in interviews or in, you know, re-edits or things like that to try to refine what each of them were saying. And the fact that they're both going to do it together for the first time makes me think that they now understood what they've made and can sort of make a little side bubble off of that. I don't want to be too specific about what I think is going to happen, but I will say that after I finished watching all the Twin Peaks content, I felt very comfortable, like I knew what I watched, and I didn't feel confused about any of the terms or symbolism, much like in the way, like, Noah Hawley series these days have weird visual shit that doesn't always pay off, or alien MacGuffins or distractions. I feel like I've been well-trained to absorb the entirety of Twin Peaks, including its ambiguity, and I don't feel like there's a whole bunch, like, that flashbacks will add to it, but I do think there are places to spin out some of the unexpected characters that are returning.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about Lost while I was rewatching it recently, because the whole business with the White Lodge and the Black Lodge is, like, such at the core of Lost as a show. And I know that Twin Peaks is often referenced as something that influenced pretty much every successful hour-long mystery show that has come since, but there are very literal connections with Lost, and I think that Damon Lindelof, I know people love The Leftovers, and what little I've seen of it suggests that I might too, but so I don't want to talk shade about him, but he really seems like a more like a literal-minded Lynch who couldn't figure out the ineffable things about Lynch that made it work. But I have high hopes for this, just because I think the idea of making Twin Peaks without any studio interference and David Lynch directing all 18 hours of it addresses pretty much all of the places where trouble seeped into the mix the first time around. So
yeah, and it's 25 years later, like they planted back when they had no idea.
Yeah. No, they knew. They knew.
If anyone saw the arrival of Prestige TV, it was Lynch for sure.
I'm going to be doing this. I'm going to turn down future movies and just make weird media things.
As we've been having this conversation, I want to appreciate your heads up, David. I have upgraded my cable package to include Showtime.
There you go. I don't miss That's exactly what they wanted.
That's exactly. I mean, I may or may not keep it because I can't think of anything else I've ever watched on Showtime. But
no, you can binge all of Shameless.
They have Gigolos. Great show.
They have Billions. Isn't our Merlin?
No, that's Stars.
Yeah.
No.
Stars. It's Stars is Billions, but you can never cancel Stars because they are.
No, Billions is definitely Showtime.
Billions is Showtime.
Oh, okay. My bad.
You're in the black lot.
Be that as it may, Stars is, at any given point of any day, one of their channels is playing Jerry Maguire, and that is a service that is too valuable for me to sacrifice.
So, Twin Peaks coming back on Sunday.
Three episodes.
I think I know what's happening. I think I know what's happening.
Good luck. I think it's only two.
I believe it's the premiere episode, then two more that are going to be on the Showtime app.
Oh, wow.
God.
We have to figure out a way to watch it in Cannes. It's playing on the big screen at Cannes, but not until the 25th. And I figure that that's probably too long, so we're trying to figure something way around this.
TV at Cannes, no!
Nah. TV, yes. Netflix, no.
Recording this, it's Mother's Day. I had my first Mother's Day this year. It was great. I got breakfast and I got to sleep in. Everyone should have a Mother's Day.
Did anyone get you flowers?
No, because we have a cat who eats flowers. So
all you had to do was create a life inside of you that fed off you like a, I don't know, weird symbiotic
succubus?
Organism.
Xenomorph.
Yeah, who continues
I think succubus
to,
is female, so this would be an incubus.
Oh, yeah. It's because of my love of nu metal. Is that what incubus is?
I would guess that Incubus fans take offense to them being called nu metal. I think they predated formal nu metal a little bit.
Oh, man. This is exactly where I thought this Mother's Day conversation was going to go. This is not about me. This is about our mothers. Some of our mothers have been guests on this podcast, and we have talked about their taste in movies and how they've impacted us. But we want to just briefly talk about our recent pop cultural experiences with our mothers, something that they have liked, something we've watched with them. Dave, you seem to have something in particular that came to mind that was worth sharing with the group.
So my mom really likes superhero television, and Netflix added all the CW shows a while back, and so I sat down with her and made a viewing order list so that she would watch, couple seasons of Arrow, and then alternating Arrow Flash, and then Arrow Flash Legends, and then Arrow Flash Legends Supergirl, so that she could, you know, be along with it. She's now on the current seasons. She's a bit behind me, but Barry Allen has proposed marriage to Iris West, and they have a new apartment, and they've decorated on their center table a cup that is a whole bunch of colored pencils instead of a bouquet of flowers. And my mother has adopted that idea, so that today, when I went to go visit her for Mother's Day, she showed me and said, remember from Flash, the Barry Allen Iris West pencil bouquet jar.
Barry Allen! Wow. The Flash!
The Flash!
It's Catch Me. That's a Catch Me If You Can reference for anyone out there.
I thought you were quoting Dave's mom.
No.
Patches, how about you? How about your mom?
You know, I just saw her this weekend, and they were talking about Netflix or some shit, and I can't remember exactly what they're watching. They watch a lot of, like, British Bake Off and that sort of thing. So we don't really watch a lot together.
Are they the reason that you got into? Are they the reason that you got into Bake Off?
They're the reason that I became British and submitted myself to the Bake Off. Yeah, that's true. No, the last movie that my mom and I saw together was Lincoln, Spielberg's Lincoln. How long ago was that?
5 years ago, 4.5 years ago.
Wow, that was a long time ago. It was either that or the second to last Harry Potter movie. No, wait, no, that would have been 3 Harry Potter movies. Yeah, it was Lincoln. We had a great time. We thought it was too. She thought it was too long, but you know, I forgive her.
I was trying to remember what I had given my mom, because my mom always watches my screeners. Like, I leave them with her, and she picks something to watch with her book club. They loved *Beast of the Southern Wild* back in the day, and I had forgotten that she loved *Jackie* to vindicate me and my love of *Jackie*, which I really enjoyed because that movie is arty and weird, and like, I don't necessarily give my mom credit for something. She wouldn't seek out something like that, but I think because it was about Jackie Kennedy, and she. Let's see, she was 8 when JFK was assassinated, so it's kind of a formative moment in her life. So she watched Jackie and Moonlight and Fences all in one day and loved all of them. But the last movie I can think of that we watched together was the screener of Hidden Figures, which it's like the ultimate mom movie and also a big hit in my
Your mom is also an amateur actress.
Oh, yeah, she was just in Noises Off in the community theater, so... Maybe she appreciated a Natalie Portman's work on a level that I can't appreciate. David, how about you?
The last movie I watched with my mom was probably The Intern, which was resoundingly hated throughout my house.
Oh, no.
And we all watched it, and to a person, everyone was fucking angry at the movie.
It's not that bad.
And no, and anyone, there are intern apologists out there, and like these people... Fuck you all. But
I am here for the robes and the yoga of the intern.
Disgusting.
Come on, man.
Actually disgusting.
Those look really comfortable.
What my mom watches these days, I mean, she recently recommended me The Voice on NBC. Which I've seen an episode or two of and whatever. And she was like hardcore about The Good Wife. But I think that even though she sometimes surprises me with her technological savvy, I think the idea of watching a show that only existed online, the Good Fight, it was a little bit, like, maybe a bridge too far for her.
That's a really interesting point about how The Good Fight did, because presumably a lot of the Good Wife fans were like your mom.
And did The Good Fight end? Did they cancel it?
No,
no,
it's
I
coming
think
back
the season,
for season
ended
two.
Though, didn't it?
Yeah, it's back. It's coming back.
I'm curious about how that experiment went though. One of those things that we'll never know the numbers for. Anyway, this is about your mom, not The Good Fight.
What's it?
David's mom is The Good Fight.
Is your mom Christine Baranski? I can see that.
No. But my mom was also excellent in Bowfinger.
We get to meet your mom. I just thought about that. I'm excited.
How have you not met my mom?
I'm really certain.
When
I'm not
would
met
there
mom.
Have been an opportunity?
There, I feel like all my friends have met my mom at some point.
I've met David's mom several times.
Dave has definitely met my mom.
Dave
might actually
be my
dad.
I'm taking all of your money.
It's hard to say.
Oh, yeah. No, you have not presented us with the opportunity. So one more reason to look forward to your wedding.
One more. There are so many. Here's another one.
Hey, mom, there's so something in the back room. Hope it's not the creatures from above. You used to read me stories as if my dreams were boring. We all know conspiracies are dumb.
So Patches and I in this segment are going to say mostly positive things about Alien Covenant. But really the reason we're going to talk about where that conversation is eventually going to lead, spoiler alert for this podcast, not spoiler alert for the movie, is that Michael Fassbender is incredible in this movie, like genuinely incredible. I think all of the actors who have played androids in the various Alien movies have been quite good, with Winona Ryder maybe not being quite up to snuff, but that was probably more the fault of everything else about that movie than it was herself. But Michael Fassbender is next level as David. He was great in Prometheus, which is an otherwise deeply flawed movie, and Alien Covenant, for all its flaws, at least has the good sense to double down literally on Michael Fassbender, and really
on everything, this, really.
Yeah, and really, but really pivot this new prequel franchise trilogy, is probably the safe guess where it's going to be, to being about him, not just him as sort of this, this Weyland Yutani, or Weyland, he's just a Weyland product that connects to the Alien movies, but for the ethos, the themes, the heart of this franchise to be in his synthetic body. And he plays two characters in this, and the scenes in which they interact are deeply weird, especially for a movie of this nature and size, but also absolutely mesmerizing. And it is, you know, it is up there with, it will not receive this sort of attention because that's not how the world works, but I genuinely believe that this performance in this movie is up there with anything that we saw in Call Me By Your Name or anything that I'm about to see in Cannes. I'm sure he is phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pull, I'm going to reel you back in on that one and say he's very, very good. But he's not like an Oscar caliber performance here. He's just,
if
he
the
plays.
Oscars were better, he would be an Oscar caliber performance.
I think he carries this movie in an important way, and he I describe his performance and the movie in a as a whole the way Nicolas Cage describes his own acting. This is baroque, man. This is big and splashy and go for broke, and Michael Fassbender is the one who sets the pitch every single time. Like playing reserved and sensitive in the beginning when he's playing this new robot Walter, and then
is he still very Peter O'Toole-ish?
Yeah, I mean,
who is Peter O'Toole-ish? Michael Fassbender?
In the first movie, he watches Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah. You kind of see him learning how to be a person.
Yeah, yeah, he's big into Lawrence of Arabia in the first one. Well, the thing is that
I'm worried about getting
David
too spoilery.
But,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, he starts the movie as a character named Walter, who is a new generation version of the same synthetic that David was made from. He is a slightly more advanced, less vulnerable model. And he's a little bit less Peter O'Toole-like in that sense. Although I forgot that they called the computer Mother. And so I just kept thinking about Mike Pence when he's like walking around the ship going, yes, Mother.
So creepy. Everything is maximum creepy or maximum disgusting or maximum
like
ponderous, you know? It's all pushed to its top level. And that's what I love about this movie. I was giddy the whole time. I'm surprised that we've seen so many negative reviews of Alien Covenant because I think it's a director's movie.
Nerd ass shit?
Is it? I don't know.
I'm not going to call it nerd ass shit. I'm not going to call it nerd ass shit. I'm just going to call it like
giddy
surprised.
Fun. I'm not surprised at some of the reactions because I feel like this movie wants to be all of the Alien movies in their own little segments together. There are times that it focuses on just life.
Except for the one that he made, I think. Except for Alien.
Right. Well, right, except for Alien. There, unfortunately, which is in my estimation, the best of the films, there's nothing that's quite Alien about it. But you definitely get the Aliens vibe and so on and so on. But I mean, I think it's really a sloppy jumble of all these things, and that because Michael Fassbender is so good and because his character is so clearly the heart and soul of what this new trilogy of movies is going to be about, the aliens themselves, or whatever one you want to call them, they're not xenomorphs. Well, some of them aren't xenomorphs. They're neomorphs or whatever, are all really feel like an afterthought, and they are introduced to the film really as an afterthought, and they're sort of sloppy.
Well, they're not an afterthought. They're an extension of ideas. I mean, this is very much a Prometheus sequel, which I was not expecting going in. I would highly recommend watching that movie before this.
It's a very, very direct Prometheus sequel.
It accelerates the grandiose ideas of Prometheus to more blockbustery levels in a way that I found very enriching. It's kind of like, Katie, it reminds me of Jurassic Park at times. It's very much like Aliens at times, but it's
I like that
Prometheus
you name checked me for
truly.
Jurassic Park. I appreciate that. Is it spoilery to ask why Noomi Rapace is not in this? Because as far as I remember, Prometheus
Chef
leaves off of
Oh wait, sorry.
It's super spoilery to talk about it.
I was too quick to say that. I just doubled back on.
We can have a spoiler conversation about Alien Covenant maybe next week, even though we'll be missing.
Anyway, Noomi Rapace is not in this movie, so draw your own conclusions. Dave, you saw the movie, right?
I didn't see the movie, but I'm aware. I had to work late and missed my screening that I was intending to go to. But
real life, boo.
I've read it out and had some spoilers beforehand, so I'm aware of what you guys are talking about
I
and look forward to this, I guess, pivot to a performance being the center instead of the creature being the center,
right.
Because I think that's going to end up preserving whatever we go forward with Alien, because they're never going
to
stop.
It left me
the important thing about
so
Fassbender,
interested to see the next one.
The important thing about Fassbender's performance is that it gives the whole movie meaning. Like, I've seen a lot of people complaining about how stupid the human characters are in this movie. They keep, you know, walking into the eye line of alien creatures who want to burst through their chests and spread people goo all over the place. Yes, they are idiots, and yes, they believe in religion, and they believe in faith, and believe in humanity's capacity for good or accomplishment, and it's all stupid. This is a very nihilistic movie, and at the top are these androids who perhaps are a superior race to human life. And I think Fassbender sells it in this kind of dual performance. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, the movie left me with a real existential despair. this is a movie...
And you loved it.
A movie of the times, really.
Sure, but it's a movie that sort of argues in favor of our hastening decline. It's a film that really makes it clear. I don't think this will. I don't think our downfall is going to play out exactly as it does in these films. But I think that it's very easy for me to imagine, a lot more easy than it was watching something like Ghost in the Shell, which is even more directly supposed to be about this sort of thing, but is a little bit more optimistic and. Speculative and sci-fi, but anyway, that we will create some sort of artificial intelligence and they will Skynet the shit out of us, and with good reason, because we will have served our purpose. And it's not a particularly complicated idea, but the visceral weight with which the movie sells it and the spirit of Michael Fassbender's performance,
the visceral weight. It's a very, very gross movie. I think that's what you're trying to say.
I know, but I'm just saying that, like, because, you know, I don't think this movie is particularly groundbreaking in its thinking by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that because certain parts of it work so well, it really hammers home the ideas that it's trying to convey. And at the end of it, I was like, well, we are all on a ticking clock here.
You set this up.
Well, I was gonna backtrack to something David said and what we argued about, which was, you know, if the Oscars had more sense or they were really looking for the greatest performances of the year, perhaps Michael Fassbender would be up in the conversation at the end. And while I disagree, I do think this happens all the time, that we get blockbusters that have, well, rarely we get some blockbusters that have great performances and they go overlooked because they're, you know, one weekend, the last weekend was a terrible Transformers movie, and the next weekend is some garbage cartoon movie that we'll never remember again. And you see the summer just completely overlooked. And blockbusters, we never talk about the performances because it's all about spectacle or it's all about IP cash-ins and talking about what comes next. But so have we seen performances? Katie, you had a lot of ideas here about performances that were totally overlooked in blockbusters, which is...
Well, I was going to mention a few that I had thought of that were recognized as blockbusters. Johnny Depp got nominated for the first Pirates movie, which, you know, regardless of what you think about Johnny Depp or the way the Pirates franchise has gone since then, is a pretty inspired Oscar nomination. Like, that's
well,
the
that movie
thing to see happen.
is a masterpiece. Let's just say it.
The Forest Pirates is a great movie. It was a huge phenomenon. And his performance is really inspired. Like, he created something really unique. Yeah. I got nothing against the Pirates
movies. I was hoping you'd say Twin Peaks again.
Wait, isn't that The Rock? Maybe I'm confusing it with The Score for The Rock.
No, you got it right.
Not that. Yeah. And then Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive. Are we qualifying The Fugitive as a blockbuster?
I don't think so.
I
think that's a mid-level thriller.
All right. Well, I was thinking
that's a '90s. I think that like the rubric has changed. So in the '90s, that was definitely a blockbuster.
Well, the fact
now,
that The Fugitive
that would
got nominated,
The Fugitive would
not get nominated
movie.
For Best Picture now, though. Like maybe with the 10, but it's still a real outlier. But yeah. I thought about The Fugitive because I thought about Harrison Ford and the fact that Harrison Ford's only Oscar nomination is for Witness, and he has created three incredibly iconic pop culture characters. Like I think at the very least. Han
well,
Solo merits an Oscar nomination.
Because
is it?
I think there's a whole debate about whether Harrison Ford is a good actor or if he is if he executes properly.
I mean,
yeah, we can table that conversation.
That's a whole can of worms. But I mean, he's very good as Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I mean, I think either Han Solo or Indiana Jones, like at some point, you could give it for Raiders or the original Star Wars or, you know, Empire Strikes Back if you want to. But yeah, at some point in there, he should have got nominated. I thought about Judi Dench in Skyfall. She was great as M for a long time and was especially great in Skyfall, I thought, which is
what about Daniel Craig at Skyfall?
Daniel Craig is also great in Skyfall. I mean, I love
Judi Dench in those movies. It never in a million years would have crossed my mind that she deserved any sort of awards consideration for
Well, I dare any of you to come up with a woman to mention in these conversations.
I will. I'll mention one that's been nominated.
Well, hang on.
Bullock to Gravity.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Although that's a prestige blockbuster. Like it's a similar thing. It was like experimental. It had all this like interesting like ideas
and
technology behind it.
That's where these performances can thrive, right? I mean, I think Gravity is a wall-to-wall action movie. How is it? It definitely is.
It's definitely an action movie, but I don't know if it like it's because the problem
the only
with
reason
blockbuster
it's prestige
movies...
is because it was made by a director, and it was an original concept.
Well, the reason that having a great Oscar-worthy performance in a blockbuster is so hard is because usually there's so many moving pieces. Like, you don't have a great performance in a Marvel movie because there's so much pressure on it for all this other stuff. But Gravity is just about her. The third person I was going to say was Andy Serkis in all the Lord of the Rings movies.
Sure. Definitely not in the Planet of the Apes movies, but definitely in the Lord of the Rings movies.
We have to debate that. I was going to bring up Andy Serkis as the
why
apes,
would we
and
debate
I'm totally
that
down with that
when we
campaign.
Could be talking about... Why would we debate that? We could be talking about Elizabeth Debicki in The Great Gatsby, qualifies as a awards movie, as a blockbuster rather.
It certainly does not.
I think. Or what about Elizabeth Debicki in The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Stop forcing this issue, this Elizabeth Debicki issue. One day she'll be in a movie we need to talk about her in, but so far she's been completely underserved at everything.
What
Move
about
on.
Hugh Jackman in The Prestige? Actually,
Wait,
that's not. That's
I demand
a
more Andy Serkis talk here. Why are you discrediting his work in Rise of the Planet, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? I mean, they pushed for that Oscar nomination because the artistry, the craft was real. Why would you throw that away?
I mean, they send out for your consideration screeners for like Bridget Jones's Baby. It doesn't mean that
okay,
it deserves
but I'm
to be
I'm
nominated.
Buying.
No, come on.
I think what he does in those movies
the difference
is real.
Is
and
the difference. I regret to say that the. That distinction that I'm making between Lord of the Rings and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is not intellectually grounded. It's not really there's not really something interesting to unpack there. The difference for me is that the Lord of the Rings movies are great and the new Planet of the Apes movies are shit.
Oh my
so
God.
I,
shit. Wow.
Dave, where I are you? Come to me.
I mean, what? You want me to.
I thought you'd back me up here.
I mean, you're technically correct in that the Andy Serkis performance is in the Planet of the Apes movies, not
happened.
In the Twin Towers.
What about
movie.
Charlize Theron in Fury Road?
Yeah.
That would have been good, yes.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Why didn't that movie get any performance love? Is there something, is it all technical, or was the
because
fact that it
think
was
that
good
performance
surprise
is,
people?
Unless you're playing somebody with a special, with some sort of disability or something like that, I do think that people, and I understand saying this
she
in advance,
have
that
a
lot of actors are voting for Academy Awards, but I get the sense that people, especially the media, tend to see performances as the things that you say and how you say them. And I think that physically driven performances tend to, and maybe this has something to do with Andy Serkis not getting nominated for anything, but I think they tend to think that physically driven performances are not as, I don't know, valuable.
That's a. I think that's a solid point. Although the artist
may speak to why comedy.
Jean Dujardin.
Well, who knows what sort of voodoo Harvey Weinstein did for that movie?
He sacrificed Uggy just to get the Oscar.
Yeah. Oh, R.I.P. Uggy.
That was a sick.
Patrick, what were your choices in this?
Well, I'm with David. Yeah, Charlize Theron. I don't really understand how Mad Max could have that momentum. Well, I do understand it because the Oscars, especially, are all politics. And as someone was discussing on Twitter days ago, you know, there was no belief in Mad Max as an accomplished movie. All the narratives. It's funny. I remember like 2 years before Mad Max came out, people on a set visit I was on, some Fox movie, were just talking complete shit about the disaster that was going to be Mad Max. Because they flew in producers to oversee George Miller. He was spending too much money. It was all, the shoot was going to shit. It's going to be terrible. And then, of course, it's this phenomenon. It's the most important blockbuster that's come out in years. Because it's an actual director's movie with real performances and real narrative. And I think people were just so blown away that you can't even start talking about how good Charlize Theron is in this movie. Maybe Atomic Blonde will be the answer for her. I doubt it, but
it's not.
Okay, well, that settles that. Actually, you know what I wanted to ask you guys was, and Katie, this will come to you because you'll know who else was nominated right off the top of your head.
Oh, hopefully.
Was Heath Ledger deserving of his Oscar for playing the Joker in The Dark Knight? Looking back now.
I don't remember that Oscar class being super strong, but I'm looking it up.
It was not. It was like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Doubt. It was Michael Shannon in Revolutionary Road. It was Robert Downey Jr., I believe, in Tropic Thunder.
Tropic Thunder, which is a great performance in a blockbuster.
It is a bit of a problematic one, I would say.
Can
it's a little weird.
Can you imagine if that movie came out now?
Oh, no, I cannot.
It would just be a fucking disaster.
Wait, who else was nominated?
There'd be so many think pieces. It'd come out the wazoo. It'd be crazy.
And then it's Josh Brolin in Milk.
In
which
Milk.
Is a great performance.
In the Milk Toast. Milk.
Yeah, I mean, Heath Ledger created something that wasn't just like a committed performance, but it's iconic. Like, it is a piece of pop culture in the same way as Furiosa or as Indiana Jones. Like, it had, and I don't think it's just because he had died before the Oscars happened. Like, I think that character is imprinted into culture in a way that was definitely worthy of recognition.
For sure. I mean, I think for me, as someone who does not think that The Dark Knight is a particularly good movie, I think that Heath Ledger's performance does to that movie similar things to what Michael Fassbender does in Alien Covenant, which is not to say that Michael Fassbender's performance is going to ever achieve the same degree of sort of cultural awareness, or nor should it, but I think that they both really buoy that movie, and I think Heath Ledger definitely deserved the Oscar for that film. It was phenomenal.
What do you think about Nolan as a director who can carry actors to great blockbuster performances? I don't really think of him actor's director.
Yeah.
He's a very cold person. But that's interesting because I was thinking about Tom Hardy in Inception.
Tea.
That's really good. Matthew McConaughey.
I was just going to say Tom Hardy in Inception because I don't think Tom Hardy has been more charming or interesting than that in
perfectly
much of anything
used.
He's made sense.
But he makes these puzzle movies where he's moving characters around and actors around like chess pieces and whatnot. That's a mixed metaphor, but whatever. You can choose your side. And I think that they're sort of all in service to and blunted by his style, which doesn't often allow for scenes to really play out, and it has all these. It's really about momentum and
well,
the
what performance is stunted
things.
By?
But no, I was watching this documentary that they just made about Heath Ledger that was on Spike TV recently, and it was part of the Tribeca Film Festival, and they go into detail his friends remembering the process by which Heath Ledger arrived at that character of Joker, that delivery of it, and while I'm sure that because this was a really flattering documentary that. All possible credit and maybe then some was given to Heath Ledger, it really did sound in a believable way that the genius of that performance was self-generated. And I'm not going to say that Christopher Nolan had nothing to do with it, but just that arriving at that sort of dog chasing the mailman attitude and translating that into an energy, into a sound, into a snarl, that was... seems to really have come from Heath Ledger himself. And so I think the answer to Patch's question, as far as I can tell, is that if you're going to have this sort of breakthrough performance in a Christopher Nolan movie, you really have to force it force the matter yourself and have something that.
But that's totally underestimating all the other good performances in Nolan movies.
I think that's more but of an not action, great.
No, but
action
that's I'm not saying that there are bad performances in Christopher Nolan movies. I'm just saying that a lot of them, he uses the actors in a way that doesn't necessarily always allow for character to develop and for actors to have the ability to do so. And I think Heath Ledger really overpowered Nolan's style. And because it was this big comic book movie, it really supported that as well. So.
Dave, who are yours?
Oh, I mean, I'm more thinking about the overlying question, because it's like, what are we characterizing as a blockbuster? Are we just talking about, like, huge movies that the Academy doesn't look at? Because, like, there are comedy picks that I would pull out. Like, a Emma Stone Easy A, I feel, was deserving of more recognition, if not straight out awards. And then you've got, like, weird questions like, is Macaulay Culkin doing really well in 1990s Home Alone, like, worth giving him an award? Because, like, not all kids can do that. It's not a great character, but that seems interesting to me. But, like, otherwise, I think you really need to do something to stand out in, like, an action movie, which is how we've been traditionally defining it. So you have, like, you know, your Furiosas or, like, your Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2, because she becomes a different character than the one she played in 1, which is, like, a stupid waitress running girl. Like, those sort of things are Ripley initially.
Yep.
Those sort of, like, iconic things are really popping in action movies because they're so against what we're expecting in these otherwise, like, cookie cutter, comfortable, recognizable affairs. I'm not sure if popping is the same thing as, like, a Academy Award level performance. I wish I had seen Alien Covenant so I could properly arbitrate this, but I'm, like, excited for that to be the case.
I think villains pop often, but if you have a lead, if you have a protagonist who seems to be really making an impact, that strikes me as a good performance. I'm thinking of Chris Pine in Star Trek as Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not doing a Shatner riff, doing his own thing, being in this major blockbuster, but he benefited from having the first Star Trek was actually character oriented as opposed to Star Trek in the Darkness.
You know
when
I'm
Star
thinking
Trek,
of
Beyond. What?
You know, I was just going to say, you know what I'm thinking of Chris Pine in the Star Trek reboot? Never. Forgettable.
That's like a fine Chris Pine, but like most of that is like the franchise creates that. It's like we're not saying John McClane because John McClane's good in one Die Hard movie, and that's the result of the movie. It's not like Bruce Willis is bringing John McClane to life, because if that were true, we would have seen it in at least one of the other Die Hard movies.
See, I think you're not giving Chris Pine enough credit for, like, as Patches was saying, like, not doing a Shatner, like, taking a character who's iconic.
Totally.
It's not the same thing that Heath Ledger did, but it's a similar kind of challenge of taking something that's implanted in culture already as one thing and turning it into something else and pulling it off.
Of course, it not working again. Like, I don't think Pine is that great in Star Trek Beyond, mostly because Star Trek Beyond's not serving him any character work to really do. I mean, I don't find the, like, we're 4 years in space, so I'm really bored to be that captivating. It seemed to work for Star Trek people, but I found his performance and, you know, being a hotshot, having to lead a team, having daddy issues, like all that stuff really kind of worked for me and the way he packaged it in that first movie. And then the friendship with Spock, I thought that stuff really worked because of Pine. And I'm definitely high on Pine's Saturday Night Live appearance the other day. I'm like all about Chris Pine right now.
See,
I don't get myself.
That just feels to me like a well-executed blockbuster movie, because if what David's saying about Alien Covenant is true, Alien Covenant could bomb, but we'd still be talking about Michael Fassbender's performance. If Star Trek bombs, no one's talking about Chris Pine making the correct decision with playing Kirk.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
but why not? I mean,
David's
still
talking about
rewrite that narrative.
Dibicki and Man from U.N.C.L.E.
But Man from U.N.C.L.E. didn't. Bomb. And also, like,
also
not,
she's
I'm talking
nothing
about
in that
and Man from
yeah.
U.N.C.L.E. Angie Hahn is talking about Elizabeth Debicki and Man from U.N.C.L.E. People,
no
the,
one is talking about
sense,
Elizabeth
Debicki
and Man from U.N.C.L.E. We're talking about Man from U.N.C.L.E. being a great movie. You're a lunatic. What are you talking about?
But
you're obsessed
I,
with her.
Elizabeth Debicki was robbed for the Great Gatsby. That
you know who's great in the first Star Trek? Chris Hemsworth.
Elizabeth
he has
Debicki.
10 minutes.
No,
he's great. No. Yes.
Well, you'll be excited when they do that fourth Star Trek movie, ha ha ha, when they're supposed to reunite.
Wait,
that's
really?
That's not happening. Yeah, that's
Man, we were supposed to have so much Star Trek right they now, and now we have no Star Trek. Don't even get me started.
It sounds like this conversation will go on forever, and please tweet at us about the underrated blockbuster performances that you want to talk about.
Yeah, I'm sure we're thinking what I know I'm missing are blockbusters that like I don't remember because they didn't like hit at the box office but had great performances in them. Sure I'm missing that.
And I remember the feeling of walking out of a movie that's not that great and thinking there's a great performance, and I can't just think of any. I always liked Eric Bana in Troy. Not a great performance, not Oscar worthy, but I thought he stood out.
Well, Eric Bana
for not
Hulk.
Being oiled. So it was
Eric
Bana
in Munich.
Oh yeah, I mean
also
oh,
yeah, can we just general rule never compliment the movie Troy on this podcast again. Like
nope,
come
I'm
on.
Sorry.
We 100% have to have limits, for that. Katie.
I cannot make that promise.
Jesus. truly one of the worst movies ever made from concept to execution. Eric Bana in Munich, though. Eric Bana in Funny People. Eric Bana in many things.
Not in Star Trek, though.
The Hulk. Eric Bana in No, that's not true. That's not even good for. It's not even a good joke.
What about Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man 2?
Oh my god.
I didn't get to mention Jeremy Renner screaming Chems in Bourne Legacy. That's
Oscar something. Isaac popped in that movie.
He popped. Out.
And then blew up. Yep. Okay. That's it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. David will be on the French Riviera drinking wine, probably. Or just eating, like, gnawing a loaf of French bread in between screenings.
Hunched over my laptop at, like, some shitty cafe.
It is
but
very difficult to find food.
So close to the beach.
When I'm saying Wi-Fi, and they're like, Wi-Fi, huh?
It is hard to find food at Cannes. You basically eat pizza the whole time. It's bizarre.
Patches, I am not at all surprised to hear that. I think if there's anything that's consistent about film festivals, it's that
food is a nightmare.
You just don't eat anywhere.
Yeah. Toronto, whatever. In San Diego as well. The rest of us will be back next week with nothing to say about France. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the executive editor of Thrillist.com, entertainment editor. What am I saying? FightingInTheWarRoom.com. We have a website. You can listen to episodes, share them, leave comments, and tell us what great blockbuster performances that we did not talk about in segment 3. Everything is possible. FightingInTheWarRoom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. I think I may, but between the time we recorded this and the time you listened to it, have done a listicle ranking the Alien movies. I don't know. That could be exciting to watch or read. Who knows? could be on IndieWire. I don't know.
Did the Alien versus Predator movies make this ranking?
I haven't decided if we're going to include them yet. But should I?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I think it's very important because of Covenant, how it twists the premise and how Alien... There's no such thing as an Alien movie. They're all different.
Right, because the new series really retcons... I guess it doesn't. I mean, does the new series allow for the idea for the aliens and the predators who've been fighting in the underground pyramid?
Well, it depends. Maybe these movies take place in a far distant past.
Oh my god.
And,
no, these movies don't. They take place... The Prometheus makes it very clear when they take place. It has,
I have a fan theory that I'm ready to share with anyone who's listening about how these movies don't actually take place in the original Alien universe. And they're entirely different franchise. It just happens to use Xenomorph. Don't at me.
I haven't eaten dinner yet.
Okay.
Can't do
anyway,
this.
we're all on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That wasn't a segment. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, where I spend my mornings intaking the news, outputting some venom, and then disappear for the rest of the day. I usually am doing other work, including podcasts like Storm Spoilers. We will be taking on the Alien franchise this week. And, oh boy, will we be talking about spoilers, because there's stuff in Alien Covenant that is what I will classify as nerd-ass shit. So check us out this week.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com, where I am still working, even though I no longer live in New York City. Surprise, surprise. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter where you can bring us all the nerd ass shit you like. Or you want, you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
I feel like this week's lightning round question will have a lot of nerd ass.
Yeah, I was about to say those are very related.
In honor of Diary of a Wimpy Kid the Long Haul, what's a book series from your youth that deserved a multi-film series?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.